Verse 17, in Christ Jesus then, I have reason to boast of my work for God, for I will not venture to speak of anything except what Christ has accomplished through me to win obedience from the Gentiles. Again, right back to chapter 1, verse 5, we have received grace and apostleship to bring about the obedience of faith. Whenever you read obedience in the New Testament, please remember that's the only obedience we're talking about, obedience of faith. And by the way, whenever you read faith in the New Testament, don't forget that faith involves obedience. It's not just trust, it's real openness to grace that bears fruit. Otherwise it's called faith, but as James says, it's dead, it's not real, because it's not bearing fruit. The works aren't there, the produce is not there. So, through me to win obedience of faith by word and deed, by the power of signs and wonders, by the power of the Spirit of God. It's rare that Paul talks about miracles. The New Testament Gospels are full of them. But here he does, so don't think that he doesn't talk about them. He does. Power of signs and wonders, but he talks about it very beautifully. That's what a miracle is. A miracle is something wonderful that causes wonder because it's unexpected and that points to the presence of God. And you need both to be a New Testament miracle. You need to remember, and I need to remember, that what is wonderful for one culture may not be wonderful for another. And what's wonderful for one person, little child of a few months old, finds, and by the way, haven't we got a lot to learn from them, they find everything wonderful. A bee in a flower is just a cause of incredible wonder. Wouldn't it be good if we were still like that? Because it is wonderful. And what's more, a bee in a flower, for many people, is not only wonderful, but it's a sign to them of the presence of God. It's a miracle. We've got the problem, again, through our education. I think it goes back to Hume or somebody. I don't want to blame Hume for all this, but whoever was the origin of it. We defined miracle as something outside the laws of nature. What an absurdity. Nature is the most wonderful miracle around us. The birth of a child is a miracle. Look at anything through a microscope and look at the amazing thing in one little cell. Look at the stars. I don't have to convince you of this, but it's all wonderful. It's contingent. It's a mystery. It can't sustain itself. It makes us wonder about God. So it's a sign and a wonder. So what was Paul referring to with this, the signs and wonders? Well, let's look a little bit elsewhere. In 2 Corinthians, he says, the signs of a true apostle were performed among you with utmost patience, signs and wonders and mighty works. So again, it's almost the same, eh? Signs, wonders, power. So something that's powerful, wonderful, and, don't miss it, a sign, a pointer. Luke, if we take Luke, as I think we can, as a sound historical document, records a miraculous healing of a crippled man in Lystra. Acts chapter 14, verse 10. He records a miraculous liberation of a slave girl in Philippi, Acts 16, 18. So presumably in the early church, as in the life of Jesus, sometimes the wonderful things were astonishing healing. Changes that could be looked at and just marvelled at. Sometimes it was that kind of thing. So sometimes it was that in the New Testament, sometimes it's still that in our world. And we don't understand why it has such a marvellous physical effect. But that can be quite marvellous to everybody looking. When someone who's blind sees, you go to Lourdes, just to take one example, and rarely, but not uncommonly, people go there really ill and come away healed and we all have to just wonder at it, because it's wonderful. And it's a sign that come out of prayer and all that, as long as we don't draw too many. But so there, Luke also tells us, if we're following Luke, about Paul, this is in the Acts chapter 19, that, quote, God did extraordinary miracles through Paul, so that when the handkerchiefs or aprons that had touched his skin were brought to the sick, their diseases left them and the evil spirits came out of them. Now, Paul's heard that by rumour. Luke has heard that by rumour, possibly. Or he may have seen it. Extraordinary healings that came through Paul. So we're not lacking in evidence of it. And here's, well, my comment, I guess. The greatest sign and the greatest source of wonder is, of course, the gospel itself. The wonder, the power of God for salvation for everyone who believes. So, as for us, so for them. While there, some of the wonderful things were physical healings and extraordinary happenings that occurred, the most wonderful thing was people finding meaning, people finding love, people perhaps not being healed, but learning to cope with sickness in a beautiful, loving way, people being crucified, the martyrs, and loving from the cross is a much more powerful sign, surely, than someone's pneumonia being suddenly cured. So whatever happens, and I don't, you know, I don't understand, I don't need to say that, but I don't, but the only way I can enter it myself is to think that the logic in my poor little brain is that God is love. So when love is brought to bear in anybody's life, it's terrifically healing. If any of you have been through depression, or if you've been through anything, and someone has really loved you, you just know what a miracle love is and how healing it is. But how does it heal, and what does it heal, and how does the healing show is something beyond my comprehension, and I presume beyond yours. Sometimes the healing that happens shows physically, because we're only one being. We're all together, we're just one, we're not body and soul, we're just a unit. So why wouldn't it be if your psyche is healed, sometimes your body is healed? When your psyche is healed, sometimes your body's not healed. And that's got nothing to do with anything, except that's what happens, and I think we just leave it there. As long as we don't get distracted into thinking the physical healing is the miracle. The physical healing can flow from a miracle, because the real sign is this love, awakening, whatever word you put it, that people have, and that's there beyond any physical, unusual, external miracle, I'll call it. Well, anyhow, that's enough on that. I can't give you any more. That's all the evidence I've got from Paul's life on it. But it's worth noting that he doesn't neglect that. It's part of it. He witnessed powerful, wonderful things happening in his life that were assigned to people of God. I like to think that the greatest miracle that Jesus performed was the way he loved on the cross. It wasn't healing a blind man, or that was the greatest miracle. And that's beyond the laws of nature. I suppose it's beyond what we thought human beings were capable of. But with grace, Jesus was doing it and shows us we can do it too. So I go back to our text. So, I will not venture to speak, says Paul, of anything except what Christ has accomplished through me to win obedience from the Gentiles. By word and deed, yes, by the power of signs and wonders and the power of the Spirit of God. And remember, the Spirit of God is poured into our hearts. That's the power. So that, and here's his thing, from Jerusalem, as far around as Illyricum. Did he go into Illyricum? Was the Latin name for Yugoslavia, really. Dalmatian coast, you know, that joined Italy at the north, that part. So how far did he go into Illyricum? Did he get to the edge of Illyricum, which would be in western Macedonia? Is that where he was before he came to Corinth? Probably. That's the only indication we have that's what happened. So presumably he didn't just get as... He went to the west and perhaps into Yugoslavia or Dalmatian coast of Croatia, whatever we call it now. But he went from Jerusalem, and I have fully proclaimed the good news of Christ. And he goes on, thus I make it my ambition to proclaim the good news, not where Christ has already been named, so that I do not build on someone else's foundation. So one of Paul's strategies was to go where no Christian had ever been. And if you've been there, okay, go for it. He'll go somewhere else. And you leave it to others and trust them to do their work, what they're doing. So he doesn't come in as a backup. He goes into new mission areas. That was his vocation. So not where Christ has already been named, so that I do not build on someone else's foundation, but as it is written, and he quotes Isaiah 52, those who never been told of him shall see, and those who've never heard of him shall understand. So he must have reflected on that and found his vocation in that, and that's why he quotes it. 2 Corinthians 10, I'll let you read it yourself, verses 14 to 16 says the same thing at much greater length, but no different. And that's why he goes on here in verse 22. This is the reason why I've so often been hindered from coming to you. And I suggested to you, which you wouldn't remember 7 weeks ago or 6 weeks ago, that it's not unlikely, when I showed you that map at the beginning of our study of Romans, that maybe when Paul first crossed over to Europe, to Macedonia, he got pretty quickly onto the Via Egnatia, which went from the Bosphorus, you know, the Dardanelles, went through Philippi and Thessalonica, which were the first two cities he went to, and then it goes across, straight across, in your way across west, hits the coast and then Apollonia, and then there's a small sea crossing to Brindisium, and then it comes the Via Appia to Rome. Was Paul already thinking, maybe God's drawing me to Rome? Even back then, in 59, 49 AD, some 8 years earlier. I don't know. But he says at any rate he's been trying, but he's been hindered. Things have hindered him. Mission needs, whatever they were, persecution. But now, with no further place for me in these regions, so he senses that he's done all he can in Asia, that is Asia Minor, and Greece. Now he feels free. I desire, as I have for many years, to come to you. Now, he's not coming to Rome to bring Christianity there. It's already there. So he goes on, I've come to you when I go to Spain. So he's got this ambition to go to Spain, not realizing that Greek wasn't spoken. Maybe he didn't realize it. Greek wasn't spoken in Spain. So he's going to have a terrific problem at the age of 60, which he probably is at this time, to learn a whole new language. So even if he actually went to Spain, which the Spaniards like to think, and they may well be right, it looks like it was a pretty brief journey, and he decided, better go back to where I at least can talk to people. And so he goes back to, we'll do that later, to Asia, to what we call Asia, or Turkey. For I do hope to see you on my journey, and I hope to be sent on by you, once I've enjoyed your company for a little while. Just as he was sent by the Jerusalem church. Well, first of all, he went to Antioch, which is part of the extension of the Jerusalem church, and he went there under Barnabas, and they sent him on his mission. When he went to the Council of Jerusalem, Paul wasn't breaking out on his own. He wanted to belong. He knew it was. So when at the end of the Assembly of Jerusalem, they said, yes, you go to the Gentiles, we'll go to the Jews. So he was missioned. Got to be missioned by somebody. So now he wants to go to Rome and let them mission him as they see fit. Maybe they advised him against it. At any rate, he wants to stay a little while, but to go on. At present, he says, tells us what his plans are. Remember, he's in Corinth writing this. Verse 25, at present, however, I'm going to Jerusalem in a ministry to the saints. And you know what he was doing? He'd taken up a collection and he was taking the money there as a help because they needed it, because Jerusalem was not sufficient, and the Jews were sending in money to the Jews in Jerusalem because they couldn't afford to support themselves. What's going to happen to the Jewish Christians? They needed help too. So he's doing it from the Gentile church as a sign of love for the saints. For Macedonia and Achaia have been pleased to share their resources with the poor among the saints at Jerusalem. They were pleased to do this, and indeed they owe it to them. For if the Gentiles have come to share in their spiritual blessings, they ought also to be of service to them in material things. The Jews gave their faith to these people, so the least these people can do is from their own material resources help out. So when I've completed to this, when I've delivered to them what has been collected, I will set out by way of you, Rome, to Spain. And I know that when I come to you, I'll come in the fullness of the blessings of Christ. I appeal to you, brothers and sisters, by our Lord Jesus Christ and by the love of the Spirit, to join me in earnest prayer to God on my behalf, that I may be rescued from the unbelievers in Judea. Now, the unbelievers in Judea, well, two groups come to my mind. One would be the Jews who haven't believed in Jesus. So that's one group, the biggest group, I guess, who see Paul as a traitor because he was a Pharisee. And now he's kind of gone over, as it were. So they're not keen on him because he's undermining Judaism as they saw it. And he keeps appealing to them. So that'll be one group. And then rumours have been going back from all over where he's been, back to Jerusalem. We've got a pretty good spy network that Paul is against the law and he's not in favour of circumcision and he's undermining this and undermining that and he's saying love's all you need to do and we know there's a lot more things to do than love and so on and so on and so on. There's another group, however, that Paul had in Jerusalem which were a problem to him too, as we'll see, that is Jewish Christians who were still locked into their Judaism, understandably but fearfully, and didn't like Paul's expansion of things. And you find them in the Galatian letter, which we've done, many of us, and we'll find them again in the Philippians later. This group that are saying that, yes, they believe in Jesus too, but Jesus is a Jewish Messiah. So to belong to Jesus, you have to become a Jew. You have to be one of us to follow Jesus. You can't neglect the Old Testament and the Torah and the cult, and you know, because it's all there. God's will is expressed in these Old Testament texts. How can God change his mind? You follow the logic? So you've got to follow all that and do all that, or you're unfaithful to God's will. That's an understandable point of view, except that Jesus blasted his way through it, and so did Paul and Barnabas. And okay. So he wants to be rescued from the unbelievers in Judea. We know now he didn't get rescued. He stayed 2 years in prison there and then later in Rome. And that my ministry to Jerusalem may be acceptable to the saints. He wants the Christian community in Jerusalem to accept what he's bringing. And he's not sure they will. They might reject it. Because
saints
is a word commonly used. Good question. It means the holy ones. And saints, forget our word of canonized saints. Saints just means the holy ones. Now, they're holy not because of their moral life, but because they are belonging to Jesus, the Holy One. They've been loved, baptized. Saint just means belonging to the Holy One. And therefore Paul says, because you are saints, because you are holy, therefore you should live a holy life. That's the second conclusion. So these are the saints, the chosen ones, the holy ones. So that by God's will I may come to you with joy and be refreshed in your company. The God of peace be with you. Amen.